prepared to order. It is April 18th, 2007. Welcome, everybody. I'm happy to be here on this nice spring morning in the state of Oregon. Committee, thank you for being here last night. I've given Senator Gordley a little update on what we did, and I think Senator Courtney has also melodramatically updated what happened last night.
Certainly has, Madam Chair.
So I would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 586. Would you remind us what this is, Shannon?
Yeah, Senate Bill 586 repeals the sunset on provisions permitting insurance carriers to deny coverage for pre-existing conditions that would allow them to accept applicants into other plans, not necessarily the plan that they applied for. And the amendment that you have before you actually is what the bill was supposed to repeal. The bill printed as is repeals the wrong part of the law. So you'll find in your packet Chapter 590 of 2003 Oregon laws that shows you the correct part of the law that is to be repealed.
All right, and colleagues, I'm not sure if you remember this, but I think that DCBS had a concern that there might be a number of people that would end up in their OMIT program. And so we were talking about a compromise of maybe putting another 4-year sunset. But what the underwriters are indicating to me that the reason that they're not using this is because the insurance carriers or the underwriters are afraid that it may go away, and so that's the dilemma. And my rationale for moving the bill would be that we would direct DCBS to please monitor the activity that goes on, and then we would have to readdress it if all of a sudden OMIP is receiving way too many people that aren't receiving coverage. Does that explain it?
Is Doug a part of this motion?
Yes.
Because the problem that I see with this is that if OMIP was designed to be a state insurance carrier to carry high risk, those people who cannot afford to be in the marketplace. So I have a problem with this. Are we going to hear other people talk about this?
No. I would like to call so that your questions can be addressed,
yeah.
Doug Barber.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, Doug Barber here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. If I can address your question, Senator Carter, the goal of this bill is to try to help keep people out of the high-risk pool, to try to allow them to receive traditional, less expensive individual insurance and not get bumped into the high-risk pool. And to do that, it allows carriers to underwrite them for the plan that they apply for.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Another request? Can we ask the Insurance Commissioner to come up here to
yes.
There's cost in this.
Joel Ario, please.
It's with me is Steve Doty, who is a broker, an underwriter, and might be able to explain better about how exactly that works.
No, your explanation was okay, but I want to have clarification, because we don't want a group of high-risk people who cannot afford the marketplace, who were first turned down in the marketplace, to all of a sudden be put at even greater risk because they're trying to get into. Okay, so that's what I need.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, we by and large agree with what Doug just said, that the likely outcome of this bill is.
Oh, introduce yourself, please.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, for the record, Joel Ario, Insurance Administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Madam Chair, Senator Carter, we largely agree with what Doug just said, that the likely outcome of this bill, if the carriers use it, would be fewer people in OMIP, because instead of having to say, in order to accept somebody, I've got to accept them for all of my plans, I can accept them instead just for one plan. So hopefully that will work to get people, more people accepted into individual plans. And I hope that's the outcome. So far we don't know though, because we had a 4-year experiment here and nobody used this flexibility. So all of us are hoping it will get used. The reason why we suggested another 4-year sunset, and we're not wed to it, it's just a suggestion, right, is because it's another possible outcome. The health markets are very complicated, is that the carriers routinely accept people, but only for a very catastrophic type plan, a very high deductible, high risk plan, and those people under the bill would be able to say, if I don't get access to all of your plans, you only give me this one plan that I don't like, I can go to OMIP. So I don't think that's the likely outcome, but it could be that it drives more people to OMIP, and that's what we testified to back in 2003 when the bill first came up. That's why we said there ought to be a sunset, and so we're simply saying again, since the experiment hasn't really run its course yet, let's have another 4-year sunset. But I do understand the argument from the carriers that put another 4-year sunset on it and people go, well, is this going to be a permanent reform or not? And so it does have some negative impact, although as I was pointing out to Doug before the hearing, if any carriers banking on the individual market staying exactly like it is in order to make any changes in how they do business, they're not going to make any changes anyway, because every proposal in this building for universal care says there's going to be dramatic change in the individual market. So I think this argument that a sunset would somehow deter everybody, there's something to it, but it's a bit overblown too.
If I might just add, following our previous hearing when Joel talked about the statistics and how this has not been used to the extent that we would like, and we agree with that, the two largest writers of individual policies in Oregon, which are Regents and LifeWise, have both said that they are looking at ways to try to make this work for them and to try to incorporate it, that the sunset, they said the sunset was a problem for them. I don't have any way to determine that, but if we the other part of this for me is there's no downside, I don't think, in this bill. People always have they have the same rights to go to the high-risk pool if that's what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
They have a higher likelihood of receiving an offer of individual insurance under this plan. As Steve Doty testified at the previous hearing, if you take this away, if you repeal the sunset and just let it go back to the way it was, it forces underwriters to be the most conservative that they can be. And I don't see any value in that.
Madam Chair, my concern was that, number one, what kind of strategies are they using to market the plan? Because it appears to me that if people have choices, the state saves money the more they go into to the marketplace, and so I'm for that as well. But I do worry that people be caught between plans, Joel, if you will, in terms of if we are doing some kind of asset testing to see that before they are put into the marketplace, then I could live with that, because then they have choices. But there's not an asset test to determine whether they should go to the market as opposed to go to private and then come to public. Well, that makes sense to me, but I'm just afraid of them being caught in between.
Madam Chair, my name is, for the record, my name is Steve Doty. I'm an insurance broker in Portland, and I'm representing the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters, and we support this bill. We think that the sunset should go away, and that this should be a part of the permanent piece of legislation that allows carriers to do this. There really isn't any downside. I don't understand what the objection is. The market right now is very, very restrictive. Individuals with any kind of health conditions are all being dumped into OMIP because the carriers are forced to underwrite them in a very, very conservative manner. They all use the same health statements, and I can tell you just from personal experience that if I have anybody that answers yes to any of those questions, they go to OMIP. That's where they end up. The carriers just reject them them almost outright. It's very conservative, and we would like to have an opportunity for the carriers to be a little less restrictive, to be able to offer some of these plans that they're currently rejecting them for. There's no cost to the carrier to have this option available to them. It doesn't cost them to have the option available. Whether they use it or not is up to them. Why they don't use it is a mystery to me, but some of them, but they don't use it, and but it doesn't cost them to have the right to do it. And so if people can stay out of OMIP and go to the private market, that's better for them, and it's better for the market. We see in some of our large groups where we have that are experience rated, and we have retention factors that are loaded, we see at the renewal, we see a line item in the renewal for an OMIP charge, because the OMIP charges that carriers are forced to pay are becoming so substantial that they are, we see that all the self-insured plans are being charged for OMIP assessments, and it's shown right in the renewal, because there are too many people going into OMIP that don't need to be there. They could go to the private sector if the carriers would take advantage of this tool, and quite frankly, we'd like to see them use waivers too. And unfortunately, they decided not to use that. So there really isn't any downside that I can see in allowing this to happen.
One other question. So, Joel, why do we need this bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I think I largely agree with what Steve just said, too, that we've got an individual market with a broad range of choices, and allowing carriers more flexibility to pick and choose which plans to offer to which people is basically a good thing, and in the theory ought to be right. If the carriers operate on the Doty principle, it will work the way he describes, and it will be a good bill. But we've tried it for 4 years. It hasn't worked yet, and the one Steve says there's no downside. I can't fully agree with that, because we do have this discussion going on in the state about what kinds of health plans people really want and need. And if an outcome of this bill were to be that for individuals, the individual market basically becomes a high-risk catastrophic plan market, because most people are underwritten just into those types of plans, that would not be a good outcome. So I think there's possibly bad outcomes. But again, we support the bill. The only thing we're saying is it might be prudent to put another four-year sunset on it just so you can look at it again in 4 years. But as the chair points out, we can do that anyway. I mean, we can always bring back, if it doesn't work, we can bring back the bill without a sunset. So I think in general we need the bill, because it helps create more choices in the individual market. And the only issue is whether we ought to be a little cautious and do the same thing we did in 2003, which is make sure it comes back here by putting a sunset on it.
So we want to extend the sunset.
That is our position, but
Madam Chair. But the underwriters are definitely opposed. And so I would like to know, we are in work session, I would like to know where the committee is on this piece.
I'd rather extend the sunset on the side of caution. Just on the side of caution, because I understand your point. Because it does make sense. The state saves money when we get more people into the marketplace. There's no doubt about that. But I'd rather err on the side of caution, simply because we need to know if it will work, and then we'll have some data in saying we need to allow the sunset to go away since we see that it worked. But we have not, OMIP has not applied marketing strategies for being able to Mr. Doty, go out to the private marketplace and say these are the kind of things that we have in place that the private marketplace can use, and encourage that. So it sounds to me, Madam Chair, as if there's a step that has not been applied here, and that if we err on the side of caution.
But the argument is that the reason they don't use this is because of the sunset. And so that's
like a double whammy.
Yeah. So,
and if I may, as a lobbyist, I probably shouldn't argue against sunsets. Those are full employment acts for us. But I don't think it's good policy in this case. If there is a problem that were to pop up, and Joel tracks these kind of statistics, we work closely with him. If there was a problem that popped up as a result of this practice, we would work with him to come up with a solution and come back, whether that's next session or 4 years from now or 6 years from now.
Madam Chair, what is your pleasure?
My pleasure, actually, because I trust the department for tracking all of this, is to go ahead with the bill. Yes, Senator Cruz.
The reason we put the sunset on was basically because we were trying something new, I believe.
Before, yes.
Yeah. This went through my committee in 2003. Mm-hmm. It made a lot of sense at that point in time, mm-hmm. quite simply, to allow more options. And I don't remember any opposition at that point in time.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, that is right. I think my last statement on this bill, because I know you got other things to get to here, is we think the bill is important. So I would hate the bill to be held up over this issue of sunset. I mean, I think either way you decide this.
Yeah. Joel, where was the opposition in 2003?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, there wasn't any opposition in 2003.
So.
There's a new argument being presented today, which is that the carriers say when there was a sunset originally, we didn't realize that our administrative people would say that's too much of an impediment to us. We don't want to go to this well because it's got a sunset. We're not certain. So that's the argument they're making. But again, on the other side of that is anybody, if they're sitting there saying we're not going to do anything that we can't be sure is going to be permanent, they aren't going to do anything in the individual market because there's a lot of proposals to change it all in all kinds of ways. So I just think, bottom line, I hope the bill comes out. If I were voting, I'd vote for a sunset, but it's a close call to me, and I think the dominant issue is we ought to let this experiment continue with or without a sunset.
Okay. Madam Chair,
yeah.
I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 586.
Senator Gurley moves the -1 amendments, which actually repeals the sunset. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 586 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Gurley moves Senate Bill 586 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. Senator Cruz will carry the bill. With that, I will open a work session on Senate Bill 791. Shannon, will you remind us what this one is?
Yes. Senate Bill 791 creates a 24-member task force on mental health and addiction services for underserved population. Declares emergency, takes effect upon passage. The committee heard this bill last Monday when I was out sick, and some issues arose about some of the language, and you have the -1 amendment in your packet, which addresses some of those concerns.
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
I would just point out that in the proposed amendments, one of the requested changes in language on line 4 of the -1s, line 4 of the -1s, which reads, in line 26, delete ethnic minorities and insert racial or ethnic populations. That should have read racial and ethnic populations, as you'll see from the hand-engrossed copy from Mr. Davis.
We will need to bring it back. I'm sorry, committee. All right. If you have that staff, to change the word or to and we will bring it back. With that, I will close.
And Madam Chair, do you want to bring it back to our next meeting?
Yes, I would like to bring it back to our next.
Okay, that's great.
Committee. All right. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 791. And staff, if you can make sure that correction occurs in LC. Next, I would like to open a work, and we have a series of bills, colleagues, Senate Bill 944, Senate Bill, and we are not hearing Senate Bill 945, we've taken that off the agenda, and SJM 8. So I'd like to open a public hearing on both SJM 8 and Senate Bill 944, and Shannon, would you bring us up to date on what we have here?
SJM 8 urges Congress to enact legislation requiring testing, review, and approval of ingredients in cosmetics, particularly phthalates. And Senate Bill 944 prohibits the sale of toys or other articles that contain phthalates that are intended for use by children under 5 years of age.
And we're going to have Senator Carter start this off for us, and then we will call the proponents up.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Margaret Carter. I represent Senate District 22, North Northeast Portland. Joining me is my staff, John Christensen, who has been working on this bill actually since before we came into the legislature with a group of other people that that you'll be hearing about. I am pleased to bring this issue forward to you as the sponsor of a series of concepts to educate the need for safe cosmetics along with toys for our children. This is a priority issue for the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance as well. Considerable work and preparation has gone into the issues you will hear today from citizens, from Rachel's Friends Breast Cancer Coalition, the Oregon Environmental Council, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and other distinguished groups, and also citizen actions groups in the rest of the part of the state. Today, as a matter of education, Madam Chair, members of the committee, 27 nations in the European Union banned products with certain chemicals, phthalates, as does the state of California beginning in January of this year. In California, San Francisco has banned the sale of toys with phthalates for young children. Certain phthalates have been correlated to potential deformities or malformations in the reproductive system. Key among the bills on the docket today is a joint Senate memorial to Congress for the need to identify product contents, testing, review, and approval of chemicals used in products. And I especially want Senator Cruz and Senator Courtney to listen to today's science. I would like to thank the various groups that are presenting testimony today, along with the issue of labeling, which is essential so that individuals purchasing products know what it is being used on our bodies and what we are going to, what we are giving to our children to play. I'd like to give thanks especially to Ms. Lund and Ms. Gretchen Lee from the Breast Cancer Fund, who came from California specifically for this hearing to advise us on what steps other communities are taking to bring this issue forward. This is our first step in the legislature to bring this issue before the public and policymakers to let women and men know that products need education and not all products are without risks. That healthy policy and good public policy require us to look beyond what we might assume. I'm sure that you're going to find it equally shocking as you listen to other testimony from people today in terms of some of the effects, especially around the issue of birth on this chemical that we are referring to today called phthalates. And Madam Chair, I appreciate your allowing us to bring this bill before you today, and I appreciate the committee for wanting to take some level of action in the protection of our children as they are in gestation, even to have the kind of exposure to the kind of chemicals that women use on their bodies in our society today. John, did you have some comments?
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Christensen, and I'm staff with Senator Carter. We've been working with the proponents, and also we've had dialogue with the industry, the American Chemical Council, and there are proposed amendments to Senate Joint Memorial 8, which later on we could address, that I think are amenable to all the major parties.
Madam Chair, one person's name I really forgot, and that is, I want to give kudos to Mr. Jim Marquis, who has worked very well with us on this issue and working with the people from the industry that he works for. So I want to make sure that you know that we have been working, as we know you would, to send us back out as a group to work on this issue as well. So thank you very much. I stand available for any kind of questions that you might have from the committee.
Questions? All right.
Thank you.
Let's call Gretchen Lee, Tiffany Howard, and Lindsay Capps to the stand, please. And note that we are discussing both the memorial and the Senate Bill 944.
Oh, wow, two microphones. Maybe I just need one. Madam Chair and members, thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Gretchen Lee. I'm the Senior Policy Coordinator with the Breast Cancer Fund in San Francisco. The Breast Cancer Fund is a national organization that identifies and advocates for the elimination of the environmental causes of the disease. You're being handed some handouts right now, one of which is called State of the Evidence, What is the Connection Between the Environment and Breast Cancer? It is a white paper that the Breast Cancer Fund puts together about every 18 months, detailing out the science between the environment and breast cancer. The Breast Cancer Fund is also one of the founding members of the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics, and we were one of the leading advocates for the Safe Cosmetics Act of 2005 that was passed in California. I'm here today to urge your support of two pieces of legislation, SJM 8 and SB 944. These measures are necessary steps in the right direction to better protect public health, and I'm delighted to be here today. You may be wondering why a breast cancer organization has devoted so many resources to advocating for the elimination of toxic chemicals in our products. Contrary to popular belief, nearly 50% of all breast cancer cases cannot be explained by traditional risk factors such as genetics, diet, exercise, or childbearing history. With so many breast cancer cases going unexplained, the Breast Cancer Fund is looking to the environment for answers, and we are finding some startling evidence that our everyday exposures to toxic chemicals may be increasing our risk of developing breast cancer, and that the chemical revolution that occurred in the post-World War II world is contributing to the nearly threefold increase in breast cancer rates in the last 40 years. What is even more appalling to us is the fact that many of the products that we thought were supposed to be safe are actually exposing us to unnecessary harm. Cosmetics and children's toys are great examples of a broken chemicals management system in this country. That's the bad news. The good news is that we can start taking the necessary steps now to protect public health. Major loopholes in federal law allow the $60 billion cosmetics industry to put unlimited amounts of chemicals into personal care products with no required testing, no monitoring of health effects, and inadequate labeling requirements. This lack of oversight has most likely contributed to the fact that one-third of all cosmetic products contain ingredients that are linked to cancer. Given that our bodies absorb 70% of what we put on our skin, it is unbelievable that the FDA does not even have the authority to require companies to conduct safety testing of their products before marketing, nor does it have the authority to require manufacturers to register their cosmetic establishments, file data on ingredients, or report cosmetic-related industries. It cannot even require a recall of cosmetics. If the FDA wants to conduct a recall of a potentially dangerous product, it can't simply order one like it would for a drug like Vioxx. It has to get a court order. The FDA defers to a safety panel funded by the Cosmetics Industry Trade Association. This industry panel is called the Cosmetic Ingredient Review Panel, or CIR. In its 68-year history, the FDA has only banned 9 ingredients, with another 9 being recommended for a ban by the CIR. In contrast, the European Union banned almost 1,100 ingredients for use in cosmetics in 2003. So is using your shampoo going to give you cancer or cause infertility? Probably not, if that's all you're exposed to. The chemicals in any one consumer product alone are unlikely to cause harm, but consider how many personal care products each of us use every day. I personally use about 15, so 15 products every day for 40 years. That adds up. And what about salon workers? They are bathed in these chemicals day after day for hours a day, year after year. We also need to remember the myriad of other exposures from different sources every day. The chemicals in my cosmetics are combined with pesticides in my food, industrial emissions, harmful dry cleaning solvents, household cleaners, plastic food containers. It all adds up, and it starts adding up even before we are born. A study conducted by the Environmental Working Group showed that chemical exposure begins in the womb, passing from mother to baby. Testing of umbilical cord blood revealed fetal exposure to an average of 200 chemicals, including pesticides and industrial pollutants, all while still in the womb. The exposure continues through the use of baby toys and bottles containing phthalates and bisphenol A. Much has been said about these chemicals, and I'll do my best to provide an overview of why the Breast Cancer Fund is so concerned with these chemicals. But you'll find much more detail in the handouts that are being handed out now. Phthalates are a common plasticizer found in a variety of everyday cosmetic products, such as nail polish, body lotions, and eye mascara, and they are also present in many children's toys. Some of these toys are designed to be put directly into a baby's mouth, while others eventually end up there, since that is how babies explore their environment. Because phthalates aren't chemically bonded to PVC that is often used to make children's toys, they leach out of products over time. Phthalates have been linked to a variety of illnesses, including cancer, birth defects, developmental harm, premature breast development in girls, and male genital defects. Of most concern to the Breast Cancer Fund is the ability of phthalates to mimic estrogen. A woman's lifetime risk of breast cancer is directly related to her exposure to estrogen or estrogen-like substances. Recent research has shown that three of the phthalates addressed in this legislation, SB 944, significantly increase the proliferation of certain breast cancer cells and inhibit the anti-tumor action of tamoxifen, a drug commonly given to breast cancer patients to inhibit breast cancer growth. You'll also see in the more detailed report that phthalates aren't just damaging to young girls, but to boys as well. Phthalates have been linked to impaired sperm quality, sperm damage, decreased testosterone production, and genital defects in baby boys exposed to phthalates in the womb and in the early stages of life. The evidence surrounding the toxic effects of bisphenol A are just as compelling. Bisphenol A is one of the most pervasive chemicals in modern life. More than 2 billion pounds of bisphenol A are produced in the United States each year. It is a building block of polycarbonate plastic, and it is also used in the manufacture of epoxy resins and other plastics, including polyester and styrene. It is commonly found in the lining of metal food cans, some types of plastic food containers, including baby bottles. Because bisphenol A is an unstable polymer and is also lipophilic or fat-seeking, it can leach into infant formula and other food products, especially when heated. Once in food, bisphenol A can quickly move into people, a particular concern for young children. A recent report by Environment California, which is also part of your handouts, shows that everyday use of polycarbonate baby bottles can lead to leaching of bisphenol A into food. A growing body of evidence links exposure to bisphenol A with drastic changes in the development of the reproductive system and mammary glands. Bisphenol A, like phthalates, mimics estrogen and can have devastating effects at extremely low levels. Recent studies at Tufts University found that exposing mice in utero to bisphenol A at doses well below EPA's established safe harbor levels alters mammary gland development in ways associated with the development of breast cancer in mice and in humans. Bisphenol A-like phthalates have also been linked to early puberty, which is also a risk factor for breast cancer. It isn't surprising that bisphenol A has these devastating effects on our children, considering that it was originally developed as a synthetic estrogen replacement in the 1930s. What are we doing making baby bottles with a synthetic estrogen? Disagreements with the scientific literature implicating bisphenol A disagreements with the scientific literature implicating bisphenol A in a wide array of health effects have come almost exclusively from the plastics industry scientists, who claim they are unable to replicate studies showing BPA can cause harm. An analysis by two leading experts, which you also have in your handout, reveals a clear pattern of bias in reporting research findings. As of December 2004, a total of 115 studies of the health effects of low-dose bisphenol A had been published. None of the 11 studies conducted by industry showed adverse health effects at low levels, whereas 94 out of 104 government-funded studies conducted in academic laboratories in Japan, Europe, and the United States did find adverse health effects from low bisphenol A levels, often at much lower levels than what is determined to be safe by the EPA and by industry scientists. For hundreds of years, it was thought that the dose makes the poison. In other words, the toxicity of a chemical is related to its dose. However, new research is finding that this simply isn't the case. Recent studies have shown that very low doses can have extremely toxic effects, especially on the most vulnerable among us. You will hear from the chemical industry that no study has shown either of these chemicals to directly harm anyone, that there is no smoking gun. Unfortunately, with the myriad of chemicals that we're exposed to every day, there never will be a smoking gun, especially when we're dealing with a disease like cancer, which often takes decades to develop. Hundreds of animal studies have shown the link between the everyday exposure to these chemicals and the negative health outcomes I have outlined. The evidence is mounting. When it comes to protecting our children, we should be doing everything we can to act on early warnings of harm. Overwhelming evidence has shown that disastrous health effects have occurred from low-dose exposure to phthalates and bisphenol A. We should not be putting these chemicals into products intended for children, especially when safe alternatives exist. Our children deserve better than what we are giving them now, and we deserve better than what the FDA is giving us now. I urge the committee to act on the overwhelming evidence before it and tell Congress to give the FDA the authority it needs to better regulate cosmetics and to phase out the use of these two terrible chemicals from our children's products. The evidence is on our side, and that evidence is growing stronger every day. Thank you for allowing me to speak to you today, and I welcome your questions. Any questions? Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, honorable members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to come in support of Senate Bill 944. I'm Tiffany Howard. I come here as a concerned mother as well as a concerned scientist with a doctorate in developmental biology from Oregon Health and Science University. I have a 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, and an 8-month-old baby. Senate Bill 944 would prohibit the sale of toys or other articles that contain phthalates and are intended for use by children under the ages of 3. Senate Bill 944 acknowledges that what the scientific community has long known, that phthalates are harmful to human health and have no place in children's toys. Phthalates are chemical substances that make plastic soft and flexible. They are widely used in a variety of children's toys, including soft plastic toys that often end up in their mouths. This is problematic given the ability of phthalates to leach out of products over time. Many of these products are not labeled as containing phthalates, yet we know that the human exposure to phthalates is widespread. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have found that over 95% of Americans tested had detectable levels of phthalate breakdown products in their urine. Excuse me. Phthalates have been well studied for the reproductive harm in animals and have been linked to similar problems in humans. In the past 4 years, studies from the CDC and Harvard have shown that phthalates are associated with a number of reproductive abnormalities in humans, including early puberty onset, preterm delivery, feminization of male genitals, low sperm counts, and damaged sperm DNA. Thank you. These adverse health outcomes are seen with phthalate levels that are found in almost 25% of women in the U.S. Given the growing scientific evidence demonstrating the health hazards of these unnecessary, dangerous chemicals, the health hazards posing to children, action must be taken to protect our most vulnerable population. And as a mother, as a scientist, and as a concerned Oregonian, I urge you to support Senate Bill 944 to protect the health of Oregon's children. Thank you for the opportunity to comment today.
Madam Chair, distinguished members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lindsay Capps. I'm Legislative Director for the Oregon Environmental Council. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today. I'm actually speaking on behalf of Renee Hackenmiller-Paradis, who is our Program Director for Environmental Health. And in her past life before OEC, she was a researcher at Oregon Health Sciences University and holds a doctorate in genetics. I come here to speak in support of SB 944. Because this is really based on a basic premise, which is that as a society, we have a responsibility to protect our most vulnerable, especially our children. And we have a responsibility to promote their full potential in the policies that we enact. And part of that means empowering parents to make sound choices when it comes to their child's health, their development, and their well-being. With baby toys, we know there are real dangers from phthalates. The scientific evidence is clear, and it's mounting. Some toy manufacturers have voluntarily removed product lines that contain phthalates, given these risks, but others have not. So for parents today, there's really no way for them to know whether a toy has phthalates or doesn't, and therefore, they have no way of knowing whether a product will help or hinder the health and development of their child. That's of particular concern to me as a brother of an expecting mother, that she has the ability to make those choices. And so I think what we need to be thinking about are ways of enacting stronger product safety rules around these particular products, given the science that has been spoken to today. And part of that is prohibiting the sale. It's very hard to be an informed consumer when the information is out there, so we ought to just take these products off the shelves, given that there are alternatives, given that toy makers have shown that they can make these products without phthalates, and therefore we support this bill and thank Senator Carter for her leadership on this issue. Thanks very much.
Questions for this panel?
Yes,
Senator Carter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What kind of alternative, what toys are out there that are not, that does not have phthalates in them? Because I think that's something that I know in my office when we send out mail to other organizations, because we have a lot of male and female organizations at the grassroots level who are supporting this issue. So I want to be able to offer alternatives and talk about those toys and those bottles that don't have phthalates in them.
Well, and you may be able to speak to this as well. I know that products made by Gerber, Brio, Lego Systems are all phthalate-free, excuse me. And I know there are lists out there that,
okay,
that show which ones. I'd be happy to provide that to the committee.
Yeah, because I'd like for my staff, as we're working with these organizations, to give them that information.
The other thing I will say is that a study put out by Environment California in January of last year, I believe, they looked at several toys and tested them for phthalates. And while I applaud the manufacturers for removing phthalates, sometimes there have been a few products that are labeled as phthalate-free and that still contain phthalates in them. So that's why I think a bill like this is very necessary. That I think it's wonderful that many manufacturers have taken the steps necessary to remove these terrible chemicals, but unfortunately, if it's a self-policed endeavor, sometimes we can't always trust that.
Okay.
Any other further questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much. First, I'd like to also thank Senator Carter for her leadership in bringing this issue forward. It's so important. I'm wondering, this prohibits, Senate Bill 944 prohibits sale of toys, et cetera, for children under five.
Mm-hmm.
How did we land on five as opposed to children under 10, or
sure,
how did we get there?
Well, for a couple of reasons. First, children under five are more likely to be putting toys into their mouths as a way of exploring their environment. And so that's why these chemicals are so problematic in toys. It's not the fact that they are necessarily there. It's the fact that they're leaching into children's mouths as they chew on them, as they suck on them. So that's why the under five provision was chosen.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to call up Neha Patel, Diane Lunn, and Leanne Park.
I just want to give thanks to Ms. Lee again for coming all the way from California.
Yeah, from San Francisco Bay Area. That's a beautiful area.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Neha Patel, and I'm the program director for the Oregon Center for Environmental Health. The center is a 501c3 organization that is dedicated to protecting public health and the environment through promoting alternatives to the use, disposal, manufacture, and release of toxic chemicals. For the past 7 years, the center has been coordinating the Oregon chapter of the Healthcare Without Harm campaign. Healthcare Without Harm is an international coalition, and it is made up of over 450 different members representing 50 different countries, and it's working to make healthcare more sustainable without compromising patient safety and care, so that the practices of healthcare are actually preventing any harm to public health or the environment. I'm here today on behalf of Healthcare Without Harm and the Oregon Center for Environmental Health to urge you to support the measures that are before you today. The oath taken by every medical professional is to first do no harm. Under this oath, when an activity raises threats of harm to human health, precautionary measures should be taken, even if cause and effect relationships are not fully established scientifically. Over the past 7 years, medical professionals have been applying this precautionary principle to forge a voluntary movement away from the use of phthalates in healthcare. This has been demonstrating the growing market shift away from these problematic chemicals. In 1999, Kaiser Permanente, the health maintenance organization, promised to eliminate phthalates in their medical supplies and hospital supplies. Demand from Kaiser helped to develop a new market for different products, such as medical gloves, carpeting, wall covering, and different building supplies. And so that their statement to actually go forward to reduce these phthalates actually promoted new development of products. In Oregon, hospitals such as Legacy Health System, Providence Health System, OHSU, Sacred Heart Medical System, Good Shepherd Healthcare, and Kaiser have all put forward policies that are phasing out the purchasing of phthalate-containing medical devices. While the Healthcare Without Harm campaign members have been successful in phasing out these products in their use, there have been some hindrances in our efforts, and it's primarily due to the lack of labeling of these products. Medical professionals and purchasing professionals within the hospital systems have really spent hours calling different manufacturers to find out what is in this product, and it's really hard information to obtain because of the lack of comprehensive labeling. Labeling these products so that they can be quickly identified would really translate into more staff time and resources that can be focused on patient safety and care rather than spending the time on the phone trying to figure out what is in the products. In the 21st century, we envision a world where our children are healthy and thrive. And banning the sale of these toys containing these harmful phthalate chemicals and requiring all manufacturers to label these products are a good first steps towards this shared vision. Ultimately, your positive action on these measures will contribute to a healthier community and environment. I'd like to thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Questions?
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
I would just like to ask Ms. Patel, first of all, thank you. And if you would say hello to one of your board members, Beth Englander.
Sure.
Beth was an intern in my office in the 90s when she was a law school student at University of Oregon. And Beth also wrote the environmental justice executive order for then-Governor Kitzhaber. Think of her fondly.
Okay, I will.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Is this on? My name is Diane Lund, Musicant, and it's a great privilege for me to be here today. I'm just going to speak extemporaneously. I am the co-founder of Rachel's Friends Breast Cancer Coalition. I was privileged to help found it 8 years ago with a woman you may remember being in these halls many times, Karen Whitaker. We both are breast cancer survivors. I'm proud to say I've been a survivor for 11 and a half years, and I am very concerned about the risks posed by our environment. I want a world that, you know, can start and start beginning to stop this epidemic. I believe we need to protect our children, our grandchildren, our friends, and our colleagues. And Senate Bill 944 and SJM 8 are a step in that direction. I've been very privileged to see tremendous support for this legislation. I'm a volunteer. I've come down to Salem numerous times, and I'm told I have a lot of passion, which I guess is okay. But I just want to reiterate the groups that are supporting this, just so you know. We have wide support. Oregon Environmental Council, the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Center for Environmental Health, OSPR, the Oregon Toxics Alliance, the Oregon Nurses Association, Physicians for Social Responsibility, Oregon Chapter, the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice in New York, and the Breast Cancer Fund. And I just hope that you will, in fact, pass both bills. I want to commend Senator Carter for taking this issue on. It's very complicated. I never heard of a phthalate before 8 or 9 months ago, and you probably didn't either.
I didn't.
But I think we need to basically protect our families, our children, our future generations, and this is a step in that direction. It's a bold step, and I encourage you to pass legislation. Thank you very much.
Hello, my name's Leanne Park. I'm an intern with Rachel's Friends Breast Cancer Coalition. I'm here with them today. And I'm a registered nurse. I work at Legacy Emanuel. And I'm here to kind of just represent my concerns as a consumer. I've been working really heavily with Rachel's Friends on the cosmetics issue specifically. And the thing with cosmetics here for all of us who aren't little children, when you're putting lotions or chemicals on your body, they're being very quickly absorbed into your bloodstream. And with most of us women, we wear the same cosmetics every day, you know, for 20, 30, 40 years. You use the same shampoo or soap or lotion, deodorant, toothpaste. And unfortunately, we're finding that some of these products have very, very high levels of phthalates in them. And they don't need to be there. You don't need to put a phthalate in certain types of cosmetics in order for them to be effective. The other thing is cosmetics are currently labeled, but phthalates are not included in the label. The patent law, federal patent law, protects companies from having to put phthalate on the label. So as a concerned consumer, when I'm out there shopping in the aisle and voting with my dollar, it's almost impossible for me to vote towards companies who are sustainable and who are interested in protecting our health by not putting phthalates in their products, because I'm completely unaware of what's in them. Right now there's several organizations at grassroots levels trying to work on this movement of having consumers be pressured by, I mean, having companies be pressured by consumers to make safer products. But right now we're still just at the very, very tip of the iceberg on that movement. And SMJ8 especially would really help us address this, at least put the bug in the ear at the federal level that this is something that really needs to be addressed federally. As states, we can only do so much, you know, but there's a lot of federal preemption around this issue, and we need to, as a whole country, decide that this is an issue that we need to protect our citizens from. So SMJ8 would just be a really great starting point for what's sure to be a long battle. So I really appreciate your guys' time.
I have a question. Are there products out there that are phthalate-free, and are there a list? Because maybe that's what we need to be doing, rather than tying the hands of industry, getting the word out to people on which cosmetics truly are safe, proven safe.
Well, it's really interesting that you mentioned that. I think there's two different issues here. But currently, there's a campaign for safe cosmetics that has put several years into researching this. They have a web page, and they have created a pledge that companies can voluntarily sign, pledging that their products will be phthalate-free and also free of several other harmful chemicals. And there's a list. Over 600 companies have signed on to this pledge nationally. The two largest, most well-known companies on that list are Burt's Bees and The Body Shop. Many of the other companies are smaller.
What's the first one?
Burt's Bees.
Burt's Bees.
Mm-hmm. So those are currently the two big names.
That's B-E-R-T at Burt's Bees.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Burt's Bees.
It's based on a honey wax.
Yeah, it is.
Bee wax.
I use that.
So there is, if you're a really interested consumer and you know about that web page and you go to it and you look at the list, you can find a little bit of information.
And the web page is, again?
It's the
safecosmetics.org.
Safecosmetics.org.
But the large companies, Senator, have not signed that pledge, such as Revlon, Avon, Estée Lauder.
And
that's the issue. Mm-hmm. That's why we feel we need some, you know, we need to take this issue to Congress. Our goal is to ask the legislature to pass this memorial so that we can basically take this issue to Senator Wyden and other, you know, other congressional delegation to basically, you know, eventually hold hearings at, you know, in Washington, D.C. and make this issue known.
And that brings me to your second issue about tying the hands of industry. At some point, we have to determine how much do we want to limit industry in their ability to harm our citizens, whether intentional or not in any way. We have, you know, identified that this chemical is harmful to adult humans, to infant humans, to humans in womb, you know. It harms everybody. So it actually, in a way, can actually motivate new industry, you know. We've seen that in the environmental movement as a whole, green building, green chemistry. You know, this actually motivates new industry. We can lead the world in creating things that are safer. And we're going to see a lot of those changes, you know, as the next decades come out, and we can choose whether or not we want to be pioneers in this effort or whether or not we want, you know, to let someone else decide for us. And right now, someone else is deciding for us, and that's the chemical associations that are putting all these chemicals in our cosmetics.
Right. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Just a statement you just made, thank you, Madam Chair, that you have scientific studies that show that phthalates harm humans, so there are definitive studies
yes.
that show
yes, there
that
are.
There have been harm to humans in the womb and other...
Yes, there have been studies done. And we've given you references and studies as well, I believe, that you have, and the information that Gretchen Lee provided.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The main investigator is a physician named Dr. Shanna Swan, who's done a tremendous amount of work in this area and funded by the NIH.
She's actually a PhD. In epidemiology.
And yes. those studies are somewhere in here?
Yes.
Where in here would I find them?
Her study is one of the stapled packets.
Okay.
And her study actually was one of the first study to identify a human link. She studied pregnant women, so she tested their phthalate levels while they're pregnant. They gave a urine sample. It's very easy to identify the metabolites, and then she just held on to them. And when those babies were born, all of the women in the study agreed to let their babies be examined, and she found a correlation between the babies who had come from mothers with high phthalate levels and a decreased anogenital distance in those baby boys, which is actually an indicator of the babies were not masculinized enough, so that their reproductive system was harmed in the male infants by the increased level of phthalates in the mothers, probably. Now, that's a correlation. That's a first study. She's working on secondary studies, and there are other people who have done studies to verify her research. And this, like I said, is just the tip of the iceberg. So we know that it harms the reproductive system. Do we know if it does anything else to any other kind of part of the body? Not yet. They're working on it. But how long are we going to wait? You know, will this alter the brain? You know, does it alter any other organ system that's being formed? We don't know yet. But, you know, there's suspicion that probably...
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Is there anything in the material that you have given us that talks about so-called organic products? And can you speak to that industry? And
well, what basically provided that information, this is Diane Lund again, mm-hmm. on the Safe Cosmetics website.
Okay.
I want to reiterate that this legislation, the memorial that we're asking you to vote on, basically would require labeling and pre-testing. We're not after a ban on the cosmetics and personal care industry.
Mm-hmm.
What we're doing is we're asking for awareness of this issue so that consumers can make an informed choice. We believe that it's a right-to-know issue. People should know what's in the products they're buying. Just like other movements have come out, you know, we know what's in our foods. We need to know what's in our cosmetics. Right now, there's no disclosure of the fragrances and flavorings in cosmetics personal care product industry. And we believe that consumers have the right to know. And this is a federal issue, but we want Oregonians to stand up and say that we want this to happen. And we urge the legislature to vote on this.
Mm-hmm. And there are products that say natural or all natural mm-hmm. that do contain phthalates. Natural does not necessarily mean phthalate-free.
I really appreciate you making that point and adding that clarification. And to Ms. Lund, I would like to say I really appreciate your passion.
Thank you.
A requirement for living in the world that we live in is passion.
Thank you.
Spoken
Thank you
and unspoken. Thank you. Keep
Thank
bringing
you.
It
Thank
forward.
Thank you. I just want to let you know Rachel's friends, who Rachel is, was Rachel Carson. And she fought during the 1950s to ban DDT in this country and was successful. And I'm sure, I don't consider myself a Rachel Carson, but I'm sure back then the same questions are being raised. But she was successful. She was also a botanist, and she was a breast cancer survivor, and she died of cancer. And we are dedicated to her memory. Our goal is and will be to try to focus on the environmental causes, to put more attention on what's causing cancer. The cure is very important. The cure saved my life and the life of many of my friends. But we have to begin looking at the causes. There's not one simple cause. I don't believe that. But we need to protect our citizens. We need to protect our children and our grandchildren.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I just want to say to those of us who have the passion for this issue, it took us I don't know how many years to bring to the attention of the American people the detriment of smoking in one's body, and we're still having that fight. So I don't know about you. This is a new day in my life for going forward with this issue. So I'm not discouraged about people who don't believe, so we're going to always have non-believers.
And I think it's extremely important that, I mean, I take a look at our pet food that we've had, and there were ingredients in there that have actually made our pets die. So I think this is an issue we truly need to be very, very diligent about, and we need to encourage and mandate in certain cases industry to pay far more attention to the products that they're using that could potentially harm. All right, any other questions for this panel?
Thank you so very much for listening to our concerns. I really appreciate your time.
We have two more proponents, Laura Etherton and Martin Dubin?
Donovan.
Donovan. Is Gail Shibley, do you want to speak also? No.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak today in support of Senate Bill 944. My name is Laura Etherton. I'm the consumer advocate for Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. And I first want to thank you for considering this important legislation and thank Senator Carter for bringing this forward. This is an issue that OSPIRG has been tracking and researching for a number of years, and it is very good that the Oregon legislature is looking at this. I've submitted some written testimony that includes a study that OSPIRG did. It's actually our 21st annual study of toy safety, and the 2006 report is what I included excerpts on that that focused actually on phthalates in toys, and this is an area where we've been concerned with the existence of phthalates in toys for all the reasons that you've already heard today about the potential health effects, especially for children in critical stages of development, and especially at times when they're putting a lot of things in their mouths, and products that have phthalates in them that readily leach out are of concern. In particular, I wanted to draw your attention to one of the factors that we found in the last couple of years of doing this study, that phthalates, the toy manufacturers, I think, are beginning to recognize that consumers do not want necessarily phthalates in toys, especially for very young children. And what we've been seeing, and initially commended this process of a number of toy manufacturers labeling products as phthalate-free. When actually as part of a different study we were testing, putting through lab tests products to see what was actually in them, we were surprised to find that a number of the products labeled phthalate-free, ostensibly to help give consumers more information about being responsible purchasers, in fact contain detectable levels of phthalates. And I should note, in 2005, about 6 of the 8 products that we tested in labs were found to contain phthalates. In the 2006, that number was down to 2 out of 8, so that's an improvement. But it's still of concern that the labeling itself cannot always be relied upon, and so that's an area where the labeling itself is not, it's unregulated. So there's no rule saying if you put phthalate-free on a product, it actually has to be free of phthalates. Seems like common sense, but is an important piece. I also just wanted to note that you've heard compelling testimony about the potential health effects here, and really toys ought to be fun for children. They ought to help them explore their world and learn and grow and have fun. And when there's clear alternatives, there's no reason for toys to contain products that can put children's health at risk. And I encourage you to pass Senate Bill 944 to help make sure that toys are safe and healthy for children. I think that the evidence is fairly compelling and definitely leads us to believe that it's appropriate to take this action at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. And I need to call Lisa Arkin up also.
My name is Martin Donahoe, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak before this committee. A little bit of background on myself. I practice internal medicine, and I teach courses in the School of Community Health and the Women's Studies Department at Portland State University. I'm also on the Board of Advisors of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and I'm the Chief Science Advisor for their Campaign for Safe Foods. Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility is the Oregon chapter of National Physicians for Social Responsibility, which is co-recipient of the 1985 Nobel Peace Prize. I have over 100 publications and speak nationally and internationally about environmental health. And I'll let Senator Cruz know that my handout does contain both references for animal and human data relevant to phthalates. At one point here, I will divert a little bit from my written testimony to describe a couple of fundamental principles of public health that have been raised by my previous discussants. Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility supports these measures. They will allow consumers to make better informed choices to protect the health of their families and to protect children from exposure to toxins. Every day, babies drink out of plastic baby bottles, and physicians administer medication through plastic IV bags. Through common situations like these, people are exposed to bisphenol A and the phthalate class of chemicals. While acute poisoning from these chemicals are rare, low-dose exposure is associated with a variety of detrimental health effects. Bisphenol A and phthalates are endocrine disruptors. Exposure during fetal and child development can disrupt hormone function critical to normal development. I'll first discuss the potential health effects of bisphenol A. One of the main uses of bisphenol A is the manufacture of polycarbonate plastics and epoxy resins. A large number of consumer products are made with polycarbonate plastic. Baby bottles, water, milk, and juice bottles, microwavable plastic, and plastic eating utensils. Bisphenol A is also used in metal can lining, nail polish, CDs, water pipes, artificial teeth, and as an inert ingredient in pesticides and flame retardants. Bisphenol A is a persistent toxin found in waterways and in our bodies. It has been measured at levels shown to alter development in umbilical cords and placental tissue and transfers rapidly to the fetus after maternal uptake. The bond connecting bisphenol A monomers is unstable, and when the polymers degrade, bisphenol A is released into food or liquid in the container. It leaches from plastic easily. Plastics leach bisphenol A at room temperature. Acidic liquids, high temperatures, and cut or scratched plastics increase the risk of leaching. Recent studies find that exposure to bisphenol A, especially perinatal exposure, has an alarming number of potential health effects. In animals, perinatal exposure is linked to precancerous lesions, aneuploidy, which is a genetic abnormality, abnormal sexual differentiation, altered patterns of estrous cyclicity or hormonal cycling, altered plasma LH levels, LH being a hormone released by the pituitary and involved in the production of estrogen and progesterone, and abnormal prostate development. In adult human and animal studies, exposure corresponds with insulin resistance, which is related to diabetes, miscarriages, prostate cancer, hyperactivity, altered female and male reproductive organs, changes in brain structure, egg genetic damage, changes in maternal behavior, accelerated conversion of a specific type of fibroblasts to fat cells, abnormal androgen or male hormone receptor activation and mitogenesis, which is cell division, altered glandular cell function, altered breast gland development, lower sperm production, lower testosterone levels, polycystic ovary disease, and accelerated growth and puberty. Bisphenol A mimics estrogen and attaches to the estrogen receptor, which can lead to similar physiological effects as those caused by the body's own estrogen. In addition, it has the capacity to bind to a membrane receptor in cells and initiate a more rapid response than the traditional estrogen receptor does in the cell's nucleus. Finally, it affects gene activity normally stimulated by thyroid hormone in a dose-dependent manner. With respect to the potential health effects of phthalates, these chemicals are used in a number of plastic products in order to soften the plastic. 1 billion pounds of phthalates are produced per year and are used in perfumes, children's toys, hairspray, lubricants, wood finishers, car interiors, medical equipment, paint, adhesives, and cosmetics. The Centers for Disease Control conducted a study released in 2000 that found high levels of several phthalates in Americans. Of most concern was the disproportionate number of women of childbearing age with high levels of a particular metabolite, DBP. The CDC study also found that African Americans have higher levels of several phthalates. Phthalates have been measured in urine, serum, breast milk, and amniotic fluid. Humans are exposed through ingestion, inhalation, dermal or skin absorption, and percutaneous exposure, again through the skin. Phthalates are not chemically bound in plastics and leach easily from the plastic. While use of phthalates is declining slightly, phthalates compose 90% of the chemicals found in household dust. While the mechanisms of toxicity for the range of phthalates varies, several forms, including DEHP, BVP, DVP, and perhaps DINP, all forms of phthalates, are all anti-androgens. In other words, they act against testosterone and other male hormones. They interfere with testosterone synthesis. At high levels, exposure to phthalates cause cancer and infertility. Low-level exposure is of great concern because of the common use of phthalates in consumer and medical products. Low-level exposure to phthalates and their metabolites is associated with developmental effects including premature birth, sperm and DNA damage, and something called phthalate syndrome. Low testosterone in fetal males, hypospadias, or development of the urethral opening along the underside of the penis instead of at the tip of the penis, inhibition of normal scrotal development, undescended testes, which is associated with an increased risk of testicular cancer, and finally, testicular tumors. The American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended research on the effects of phthalates on both fetuses and infants. One human infant study found phthalate levels significantly correlated with scrotal size, penile volume, and degree of testicular descent. Phthalate exposure is also correlated to allergies and asthma in children and low sperm count in adults. Most human exposure is from a combination of phthalates and products and dust. Recent animal studies have found that exposure to a combination of several types of phthalates increases many detrimental health effects. The European Union has banned phthalates in cosmetics and children's toys. San Francisco has banned the sale of phthalate and bisphenol-containing toys to children under age 3. And some state legislatures are currently considering bills similar to the ones we are looking at today here. The FDA has recommended that healthcare providers use alternatives to DEHP IV tubing for certain groups, such as neonates and pregnant and lactating hemodialysis patients. To summarize, the known and suspected health hazards of phthalates and related compounds are very serious. The bills we're discussing today will enhance consumer awareness and protect children from toxic exposures. And the little bit of diversion I would like to make is to say two things. One is the chemical industry does not have an incentive to undertake studies to look at the health effects of these compounds. Studies are going to be undertaken primarily by those in the environmental health field, developmental biology, and genetics. The onus is therefore placed upon the public at large to look for health effects of these chemicals among the 85,000 new chemicals that have been introduced since the beginning of the 20th century. It's also important to note that a fundamental, perhaps the fundamental principle of public health is the precautionary principle, which is the equivalent of what I took as a medical oath to do no harm. The precautionary principle basically states that when the evidence is strong, but maybe not complete, regarding the health effect of a certain endeavor, that one has to look at not only the strength of the evidence, but at the potential damage caused. If the amount of damage is extreme, then one has to involve public discussion, including full consumer awareness, and do the utmost to protect the public's health from the dangerous results of such endeavors. In this case, the use of phthalates, the use of bisphenol A, and of other plasticizers. So I commend my colleagues who have spoken before me. I commend the legislature for bringing this bill forward, Senator Carter and others. And thank you for this opportunity. Again, I'm happy to answer questions.
I'm so glad that a male actually is testifying on this, because I thought for sure it was just a female issue. So thank you. Is it Mr. Doctor?
It's Doctor.
Doctor Donahue.
Donahue.
My wife calls me Hey You. So.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for inviting me to speak before the distinguished committee, and thank you, Senator Carter, for sponsoring Senate Bill 944 and Senate Memorial 8. My name is Lisa Arkin. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Toxics Alliance. Oregon Toxics Alliance has worked on the issues of phthalates and vinyl avoidance for over 5 years in our state. we work statewide with policymakers, agencies, communities, and individuals to protect human and environmental health and to assist Oregon communities to avert and resolve chemical contamination issues and situations. We've partnered with agencies and cities and businesses and builders who have moved to eliminate products containing phthalates from use. And so thus we urge your support of the Senate bill and the joint memorial to protect children from exposures to chemicals known to be detrimental to health. And you've already heard some excellent testimony on the harm to human health from phthalates, so I won't go over that again. I'd just like to share with you a few examples of corporations and healthcare providers who have already banned the use of phthalates in their products and their care of patients as evidence that indeed we can and we should act to eliminate these chemicals from products that we use. In virtually all European nations, certain use of phthalates have already been banned for health reasons, and several countries have ambitious programs to reduce phthalate use overall. Because of concerns over safety of products manufactured with phthalates, most particularly vinyl, also known as PVC, scores of communities have PVC avoidance policies. Multinational companies such as Nike, Volvo, Volkswagen, IKEA, and NASA have instituted vinyl phase-outs because of concerns over phthalates. In 1988, the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission announced a voluntary withdrawal of manufacturing of vinyl teething toys containing phthalates and requested retailers to withdraw these products from their shelves. But it was a voluntary phase-out. And while many European countries and major industries are making significant policy changes, the United States continues to lag behind in taking action to eliminate phthalates from consumer products. A hospital and healthcare providers have stepped forward to take needed action to reduce children's exposures to phthalates. Ms. Patel already mentioned Kaiser Permanente to you. I also brought a news release from Catholic Healthcare West. They announced that they have awarded a five-year, $70 million contract to Braun Medical Incorporated for the supply of all sorts of medical products such as tubing and IV bags that are phthalate-free in their effort to make sure that their patients have the safest and most health protective care available. I'd like to read for you briefly a quote from an article that was published in the Register Guard regarding the phase out of phthalates from Sacred Heart Medical Center neonatal care unit. And here is that quote briefly. Nurse Ed McNeil discovered the dangers of phthalates 2 years ago in the tenderest of places, a thread-like tube fed into a premature infant's stomach to deliver nutrition while the infant gained the ability to suckle. After a few days, the part of the tube inside the infant lost its flexibility and turned so hard that it threatened to hurt the infant. The softening chemical, phthalates, had leached from the tube and directly into the baby. Just then, the Federal Food and Drug Administration came out with a warning. Studies of the phthalate type found in medical devices, such as feeding tubes, umbilical catheters, and intravenous bags, were shown to cause genital deformities and sterility in rodents. Today, manufacturers producing a broad spectrum of products are dropping the use of phthalates. So, I know this committee had questions about scientific evidence that phthalates are harmful, and I would just like to again bring up the fact that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has warned against using products containing phthalates in the health care of young male children, and to briefly quote a report issued by them in 2002. Exposure to DEHP has produced a range of adverse effects in laboratory chemicals, but of greatest concern are effects on the development of the male reproductive system and production of normal sperm in young animals. We have not received reports of these adverse evidence in humans, but there have been no studies to rule them out. However, in view of the available data, precautions should be taken to limit the exposure of developing males to DEHP or phthalates. That was in 2002. We know much more in the 5 years since then. And the federal notice goes on to formally recommend that medical products containing phthalates no longer be used with young male patients. I think that this is the precautionary principle in action, as Dr. Donahue explained, and we should extend this to cosmetics and toys. So on behalf of the members of Oregon Toxics Alliance throughout the state, I urge you to protect children now, our most valuable citizens, by passing both the Senate bill and the joint memorial. There's ample and long outstanding evidence to bolster your decision today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for the panel? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Maybe just one. I hear things here that seem to at least partially be contradictory, but you made reference once again to the ban by the European Union of phthalates. What was the result of the study they did on phthalates?
I'm not sure the European Union exactly did a study, but may have relied on studies by other organizations. But so I'm not sure how to answer your question. Excuse me very much, Senator Cruz.
Okay. Well, then I'll answer it for you. They did do an exhaustive safety review, and what they came up with, that phthalates weren't likely to pose risk even for newborns. So that was the result of their study, which came out after the ban.
And cite your...
The site, who is this? Oh, this is from American Chemistry Industry. So,
thank you.
Yeah, I might add there were a number of objections and a number of papers published in the scientific literature, maybe many of which are cited in my testimony, that have contradicted the claims that you make in the chemical industry study. Also that what you said about the FDA's statement in 2002, that the human study was published subsequent to that showing lower sperm levels. So,
and you have, and was that part, did you cite that in your testimony?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, you have a huge, it's like reading a dissertation paper with all the footnotes. Thank you very much. All right, there's no further questions here. I'd like to bring the industry up right now. And then I'll have the department. Jim Marquis, Joan Lawrence from the Toy Industry Association, and James Lamb from the, is it Thuenberg Group?
Weinberg.
The Weinberg Group.
Sorry, my handwriting's not that strong.
It's a doctor, you know.
So now you have an excuse because you're a physician.
I'm not a physician. I'm a PhD.
You're a PhD. Okay.
So I don't even have a good excuse.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm Jim Marquis. I represent the American Chemistry Council. I want to start by saying that I always appreciate my friend Senator Carter's passion for issues, and this one is no exception, and she and I have spoken about this issue, and I've worked with her staff in trying to come to some common ground. I would just say that I guess the reason we have a legislature here is that not everybody agrees on every subject, and certainly this is no exception. You've heard a lot of things today, and it is easy to misunderstand this issue. For instance, we're here to talk about phthalates, and I was trying to count in the back of the room the number of times that somebody said diphenyl A as if it were a phthalate, and it is not a phthalate, has nothing to do with phthalates, it is a totally different chemical, and I don't know what we're even talking about it for today. So it is, and then we're talking about other kinds of things. So this is an issue that is very, very complex. It is an issue that scientists have studied for decades, and I just want to point that out, that there have been risk assessment after risk assessment after risk assessment, and Senator Cruz mentioned the study that was done by the European Union wasn't really a study, it was a risk assessment, and it was a look-see at studies done all over the world regarding phthalates, and then they came to a conclusion that there was no significant risk. But they had already banned or restricted the use of phthalates prior to that conclusion. So these things, there are science and there are politics, and sometimes the two don't run a parallel course. I'm going to stop there and turn this over to these two certified smart people. Joan Lawrence is the vice president of the Toy Industry Association, and her job in real life is to make sure that toys are safe for our children. And Dr. James Lamb, PhD, and a diplomate of the American Board of Toxicology, and I believe his PhD is in toxicology, has done extensive research in this area as well. So I will turn it over to them. Thank you.
Thank you, and good morning. I am Joan Lawrence. I'm Vice President of Safety Standards and Regulatory Affairs for Toy Industry Association. TIA is a not-for-profit trade association composed of more than 500 members, both large and small in size. And my primary role with Toy Industry Association, primary roles are to develop toy safety standards for toys. We work with industry, government, consumer organizations, and academics in this effort. And the U.S.'s risk-based standards are widely used as models around the globe. We also educate industry on the standards so that they can comply. And we educate parents and caregivers on choosing age-appropriate toys and ensuring safe play. In addition to my 15 years with TIA and in my role as chair for Toy Safety Standards Development, I'm a mother of three young children myself, including a 5-year-old and 3-year-old twins. So my role in toy safety is one I take very seriously. I am not a lobbyist. But on behalf of Toy Industry Association and its members, I'd like to address the committee today on the subject of phthalates in soft vinyl toys, which SB 944 proposes to ban, as we are concerned that it may inadvertently jeopardize the safety of those products. It is for this reason that I have traveled across the country away from my own children today. TIA commends the bill sponsors for their keen interest in the safety of children, and we share that interest. However, a ban on phthalates and toys is not supported by the science specific to these products and how they're used by children. Further, such a ban does a disservice by needlessly alerting parents and caregivers to a non-existent threat in toys, at best, and could subject consumers to less tested, less safe, alternative materials. Let me explain why we believe this to be true. First, as an industry focused on safety, we are quite concerned by reports that ignore or misinterpret the science, particularly the science specific to toys and diisononal phthalate, or DINP, the phthalate most commonly used in toys, and ignore its nearly 50-year history of safe use. As you will hear today from toxicologist Dr. James Lamb, there is considerable evidence on the safety of DINP. For example, an exhaustive, peer-reviewed, multi-year risk assessment conducted by the independent U.S. Federal Regulatory Agency, the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission, the CPSC, that oversees the safety of toys, specifically looked at the use of DINP use in toys. The CPSC study concluded that, quote, consumers may have a high level of assurance that soft plastic products pose no risk to children. CPSC epidemiologist and lead researcher on this issue in February of this year reconfirmed the Consumer Product Safety Commission's position, having reviewed recent studies such as those mentioned by the bill's proponents today. CPSC reaffirms their earlier decision on the safety of these products. Similarly, an independent assessment by the European Chemicals Bureau, the scientific body of the European Commission, found that DINP is, quote, unlikely to pose a risk for consumers. The independent government research confirms that children are not at risk when they play with toys softened with the phthalate DINP. In fact, there is simply no solid scientific evidence that any person has ever been harmed by the presence of phthalates in toys. As you will hear from toxicologist Dr. Jim Lamb, no other substance has the solid, safe track record in toys that DINP does. And as the CPSC cautioned in their study, toys made with alternate substances could be, quote, weaker or more brittle, may break, and result in a choking hazard. We are concerned that mandating the removal of DINP from children's products will not improve their safety and will instead have the opposite effect. Toy Industry Association and its members have always recognized the special relationship we have with children, who are our principal consumers. Their safety and well-being is our top priority. It is my year-round, full-time job. We have led in the area of toy safety for more than seven decades, including development of the first comprehensive toy safety standard in the 1970s, and today continue to ensure that U.S. standards serve as models for the worldwide industry. Our efforts have paid off, as illustrated in annual reports of the federal government, which regularly lists toys as among the safest of 15 consumer products commonly found in the home. In sum, there is simply no solid scientific reason to ban the use of phthalates in toys. And in our common mission to ensure the safety of children, we urge you not to do so. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, you referenced the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Did they do a worst-case analysis of phthalates?
Yes, they did, and Dr. Lamb could better address the specifics of that study, but what I can tell you is that they both looked at the behavior of children, the mouthing behavior of children, how they mouth objects, toys, and other objects, took a worst-case scenario, observing the amount of time that children put things in their mouths, and then they also looked at the amount of exposure and used a worst-case scenario for that as well. And Dr. Lamb can address the specifics of the science.
One other question I wanted to know is, how is the Toy Association funded? Where does the money come from?
The Toy Industry Association is funded from dues collected from our member companies, and our members include manufacturers, importers, testing labs. Those are safety testing labs, design firms, and inventors. We also are funded through trade shows. We host trade shows for industry to sell their products to retailers.
Thank you.
My turn. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today. I consider this...
Just introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is James Lamb. I'm a PhD in pathology, which I received from the University of North Carolina in 1975, and became a board-certified toxicologist in 1981. I have been working on phthalates and compounds like phthalates for safety assessment almost since that time. When I was at the U.S. National Toxicology Program, I headed the Fertility and Reproduction Group and conducted over a half a dozen studies on a range of phthalates. And first, let me explain that phthalates are not a chemical. Phthalates are a family of chemicals.
That's right.
Each of which has very different properties. And what I tested was diethyl phthalate, for example, is a small phthalate. Diethyl hexyl phthalate is a large phthalate. And there are a whole bunch in between. And what we tried to do is predict the toxicity, or which is a property that relates to safety, but is not safety. I think it's important that in my years of doing toxicology, I've participated on lots of risk assessment panels. I've participated on three National Academy of Sciences panels, including one on endocrine disruption. I have five kids and two grandchildren. I know you don't believe I could have grandchildren, but it's true. I care an awful lot about kids. I care about
their safety with toys, and I also care, though, just about their safety generally. To tell you the truth, as much as I've studied these compounds and published on these compounds and worked with compounds like this at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency when I worked there, I don't wake up worrying about whether or not my child is going to be injured by phthalates because I know a lot about them. I worry about whether or not they're going to fall down the stairs, get in under the sink, or are they going to eat something that they shouldn't that's truly poisonous. These compounds have been so well studied in the laboratory for not just toxicity, because toxicity is only part of the safety equation, that a lot of the well-meaning testimony that you've heard is based on the high-dose level animal toxicology studies. But a risk assessment or a safety assessment is based on that toxicology data, a lot of which I helped develop, combined with exposure data. What are the fundamental principles of toxicity of this chemical compared to what we are exposed to, and when are we exposed to it? All of this matters a lot in trying to determine the safety of chemicals. And so as you think about phthalates, you need to think about phthalates as a family, and which phthalates are we even talking about? You need to be able to, we've heard about phthalate-free. You need to be able to define phthalate-free, because frankly, chemists are way too good. They can find phthalates, they can find all sorts of chemicals at extremely low levels, and many of the products labeled phthalate-free that where they found phthalates, it's still less than a tenth of a percent. Way less than that which would be intentionally added. But it's being found because our chemists are just that good. So you're going to have to think, what do you mean phthalate-free? Is it, it may have phthalates on it simply because it's been put in a plastic bag. And then when they measure it, it's not that the product itself has phthalates at all. It's that the trace amounts are being transferred from the plastic bag. The specifics, though, it is true. Anything can be toxic, and the dose, in my opinion, absolutely matters. The information that you've heard about ultra-low doses, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has a published position on this that was put out in 2003 that says the data are not sufficient to look at these ultra-low dose hypotheses or theories about effects. And that position has not changed. But if you look at just what's on your table, salt, water, and I'm not just talking drowning. Obviously, not too long ago, somebody drank so much water that she died. Vitamins, essential to life and at 20-fold higher than that, toxic. Coffee, as much as I love it, I have to say, even worse, chocolate. I like it even more, but it has chemicals in it that if you look at them objectively, the way we look, are looking at phthalates, if you look at, set the same standard to these substances, they are chemicals, they are toxic, and they show some of the exact same effects that we're talking about. Certainly that's true with many of the life-saving pharmaceuticals.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordley.
Thank you. Before you leave that point, some of the testimony that we heard previously, specifically from Dr. Donahoe, who was talking to us about the potential health effects of phthalates, he said in his testimony, and I'm reading from the written testimony, the Center for Disease Control conducted a study released in 2000 that found high levels of several phthalates compounds in Americans. Of most concern was the disproportionate number of women of childbearing age with high levels of a particular metabolite, DBP. The CDC study also found that African Americans have a higher level of several phthalates. Can you speak specifically to the CDC study?
yes, Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, I can. Those are really important studies because they add the other side of the equation. And the use of the term high, if you look at the levels as to whether or not they're high compared to exposures that in the animal studies don't cause adverse effects, which are lower than the levels that do cause adverse effects, you come up with a conclusion that these levels should not be causing harm. And what we do, the risk assessment process really involves reviewing all of the toxicology data available. There rarely are human studies that give us insight into products unless there's been some sort of catastrophe, which fortunately that is not the case. So you look at the animal toxicology studies, you look for the most sensitive species, you look for the most sensitive endpoint, and you compare that most sensitive adverse effect to the levels people are exposed to. And you want to make certain that people don't get exposures near that. Typically, you want it 100-fold less. For pharmaceuticals, I have to say we typically use much lower margins of exposure, like 10-fold, because we know the beneficial effect. But we're more protective at the EPA and at Consumer Product Safety Commission. So you're typically requiring at least 100-fold difference between the no observed adverse effect level and the level at which people are exposed. And if you take the CDC levels and compare them to the levels that were used in animals in these high-dose studies, there is a substantial margin of safety in the order of thousands, not even hundreds.
Should we, if I may follow up, should we not be concerned or alarmed by the findings of the CDC?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I find the CDC data to actually be reassuring because these are data taken out in the public, real people, real exposures. I'm not the least bit surprised that we are finding levels of these compounds. These compounds are absorbed. They are in our food. The low levels can come from certain cosmetic uses, but they're also excreted very quickly, which raises significant scientific issues with the one human study that has been done looking at male reproductive structure compared to phthalate levels. But I find these studies extremely useful in the risk assessment. I think those sorts of studies, as they continue to collect the data, should reassure us that the exposures are low compared to the levels that caused harm in animals. And all of the data on harm truly come from animal studies.
Further questions?
Yes.
Senator Courtney.
So, Dr. Land, there's dueling testimonies and dueling reports. We can conclude that phthalates are toxic. Is that right?
Madam Chair and Senator Courtney, yes, that is absolutely correct, that in animals, high-dose animal studies, phthalates do cause harm. They do cause adverse effects.
They are toxic. Okay. So the issue is dosage. I think that's the gist of your testimony. Isn't that right? The dosage is kept at a certain level, the toxicity, or however the right words are, is not a threat. Is that?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Courtney, really, to be clear on this, it's not one or the other. You have to consider all of the toxicity data in the context of the exposures. And for example, I have a list of the various risk assessments that have been conducted. This is where they considered both all the toxicology data and all the exposure data that were available, or worst case exposure estimates if no data were available. And these are by the Consumer Product Safety Commission, European Union, National Toxicology Program, a U.S. federal agency, Cosmetic Ingredient Review, and the CDC source of data. You have to look at exposure combined with toxicity to make a safety assessment, and that is really the process that has to happen to determine safe levels of such products, just as we do with other food additives or with drugs or with pesticides, other chemicals that have inherent toxicological potential, but under the conditions of exposure will not cause harm. I give you a personal example. As a melanoma cancer survivor, when I had to do chemotherapy, I had a plastic tube in my chest for 6 months. Now, I heard the compelling story. The polyvinyl chloride tube I had looked exactly the same when it was pulled out 6 months later as it did when it went in. But that kind of exposure is what was considered in these various documents. The one area that even came close to any concern was for premature infants who are on various either dialysis or blood processing equipment. And I have to say the question there is a very difficult one because it is the only thing that's going to save the life of the child, and the concern is they're getting close to the no observed adverse effect level. And this is why they should study those children to the extent that they can. But they're not, to begin with, they're not healthy.
Okay, proceed. All right. The point I'm trying to figure out here is they are toxic. You use the word risk assessment, so the word risk is a factor that something's going to be at risk. So we're talking about dosage. Okay, that's your testimony. So there's standards that exist, or mandates, requirements that exist, so that the shampoos, the shaving creams, the pesticides, the deodorant, not to mention the toys, make sure that the toxicity is not above a certain level or the dosage is not above a certain level so that it's not a risk. Does that all exist in law or regulation?
Madam Chair and Senator Courtney, I'm not sure that that's... I mean, I think that, first of all, it's not all that exists in the regulation because, first of all, everybody needs to understand that each phthalate is evaluated separately. The diethyl phthalate, which I have studied, is generally considered not toxic. You don't really find anything. Actually, even the more potent that cause reproductive effects still take fairly high dose levels to cause such effects. But in the end, what the regulators are going to look at, and I think this addresses exactly what you're asking, is the relative information on the toxicity of each of the specific phthalate ester chemicals, how that specific phthalate ester chemical is used compared to and determining a safe level, not just for each chemical, but a safe level for each use.
And that's the safe level is, who says it's a safe level?
That's typically organizations such as the Environmental Protection Agency, the Food and Drug Administration, Consumer Product Safety Commission, and it very much depends on the particular use. For toys, obviously, the one phthalate they're concerned about evaluating was diisononyl phthalate. In that case, they did something that FDA and EPA wouldn't do. They looked at the toxicity data on that specific phthalate, not the whole class, because this is the one that was used in toys. And then they looked at, because they were concerned about children chewing on toys, which we all should be, concerned about choking, but also concerned about what's on the toy, or in the toy, they looked at mouthing behavior. They took children and put them into a setting and actually put a clock on them and saw what proportion of the day they actually had the toy in their mouth. And from that made fairly reasonable or conservative assumptions about leaching of those phthalates and how much exposure they would get. So it actually turns out to be quite complicated and very specific to the particular phthalate and the particular use that we're talking about and the particular law that applies. For example, something found in food is going to be treated differently than something in toys. Something in the environment is going to be treated differently by the federal government in these risk assessments because they do care very specifically how these products get used. This is not simple. But one thing I really like about the CDC data is CDC doesn't care how it got there. They're taking a snapshot of how much is in our body at any given point in time. And it sort of reminds me, too, the one thing about the CDC data is they're going to talk about all of these phthalates that we talk about. When they're in the plastic, they are diesters. It's two branches of the molecule. and really this is important, when it gets in the body, it splits into a monoester. That is what causes the reproductive toxicity or any toxicity in the body, because the diester does not exist. The reason this is important is the studies on breast cancer cells that were done at Tufts used the diester. Well, the breasts would never see that form. They should have taken the split molecule. So while we're worried about phthalate safety generally, we really need to be worried about the safety of the breakdown product that the tissue in our bodies is actually exposed to. And that is essentially what we do in the rat studies, because the rat will process it. But we have to be careful in some of these studies, because the chemical may take on a different form. So I really don't mean to get so deeply into to the science, but in the end, it is complicated.
Senator Carter?
One question I want to ask was, in this country, we do worry about the science of things, but we also worry about the bottom line, which is economics. And so my question to you is, how do you account for hospitals like Kaiser and big companies like Nike, which are economic engines in this country, who say that we are going to not use phthalates in our products? How do you account for that?
Madam Chair and Senator Carter, that's probably quite a bit out of my... I don't know how they do it. I really don't know. I don't know that
much about... Not in terms of how they do it. How do you account for it? You see, none of you guys would be here if it were not for the bottom line of economics. None of you would be here. Let's just face it right now. This is about economics. And let's just get down to the bottom of it. I'm not a scientist. Will not try to go in that area with you at all until I get real knowledgeable, and then I'm going to be dangerous, okay? But right now, I want to deal with what we deal with in the country, and that is the bottom line economics. And Mr. Marquis would not be here. Some of the breast cancer people would be here because they are dealing with the science. But you would not be here because industry would not have brought you here if it was just for the science. It's economics. So let's go there. And maybe you don't have an answer for that because you are a scientist. But I have to tell you, there is no way in this country and in Europe that if indeed this was not an economic issue, you guys would not be at this table today. And not you, not even you, Ms.
Lawrence.
Ms. Lawrence. She would not be here either. And so my point that I get to is, how do we look at the economics of this in terms of our children and the use of toys, and how do you account for big companies like a Nike, like a Kaiser, with gloves and other issues that they have banned in terms of the presence of phthalates as a family and over a sustained period of time? That's when they find that the science is really bad in terms of reproductive issues and things of that nature. So I think that I want you to be armed the next time, sir, when you come before a committee like the legislature, to kind of tell us, how do you account for these other big companies saying that phthalates are present, so that we're not going to use them.
You know what I'm saying?
Madam,
I'm not trying to kill the messenger.
Yeah,
know that.
You are way out of my league on this one, I must say, because the fact is, I am here as a scientist, and the economics is something that I have to talk to my son, who's the accountant, instead of myself. And really, all I can address for you, and all I'd be able to address next time I talk to you, is to help you understand how we do the scientific assessment, just as I did it at the National Toxicology Program, or EPA, and look to somebody else about some of the economic questions and how they might relate to the risk.
Right, because obviously science is divided on this issue, okay? The CDC's, the scientists who are here from the toxicological community, the scientists from breast cancer, you as a toxicologist, your own toxicology family here in Oregon. So the science is split. That's the way it was in tobacco, and that's the way it was in other things that we have found that were detrimental to Americans. Because what I have to deal with is, how does it affect people who come to us at the when they get into serious trouble in terms of health care. That's the kind of decision I have to make. So I'm kind of like you in the sense that I'm interested in the outcomes and how it affects our state budget as a budgeteer, and that's the thing that I take a good look at. And so I'm not going to argue the science with you at all on this. And I like the way the lawyer on the end started posing questions to you, because it makes us all think about the divisionary strategies that we're seeing in this country in terms of this issue.
Senator Courtney?
Yeah, let me try another way. We accept this is a dosage and risk factors, different types of titles. If I go to Rite Aid and I buy my wife some cosmetics, or I buy deodorant, shaving cream, regardless of what I buy, is it your testimony here today that if I buy a product with phthalates in it, there is no risk to me about the phthalates? I don't have to worry about that.
It's my testimony, Madam Chair and Senator Courtney, it's my testimony that I don't worry about it. And I know these data very well. I have looked at the cosmetic ingredient review. I have looked at most of the underlying studies that they've reviewed. I've looked at all these various documents and most of the underlying studies we're talking about. And I'm not just comfortable with me using it. Maybe you might think I'm a risk taker, but I don't take chances with my kids.
This would be true of any toys at Toys R Us that I would get that have phthalates in it.
I have no concern about my grandson. When he puts a toy in his mouth, I worry about him choking. I don't worry about the phthalates that might be getting into his mouth.
In terms of the industry's involvement or the regulatory agencies, they've done all the studies and examination of phthalates in any and all deodorants, in any and all shaving creams, in any and all toys, so that the public can feel safe in dealing with anything that has a phthalate in it in terms of a toy or a cosmetic or a thing, soap or shaving cream or pesticides or all the things it's in.
I consider phthalates as a family, and even most of the individual phthalates that we're talking about today, to have been so much better studied than most of the other substances, to natural or synthetic, to which we are exposed, that I personally am comfortable with me using them, my family using them, and don't believe any of us are at risk of any harm from these.
So the studies that we have put here today, I know we have dueling studies that show that certain individuals have highlights or phthalates in their body. Is that something that we should be concerned about, or it would be your testimony that that's not a concern either? I mean, I can't cite all. I'm just here the first time listening to these testimony, but there are testimonies that certain individuals have high levels of phthalates and trusted women and things. That is not something we should be concerned.
The term high was not my word.
So those
I don't. That's if you look at the CDC values and compare them to the safe levels, these are not high levels. They're low levels compared to what CDC to what you would come up with as a safe level according to these other regulatory agencies. So the use of the term high is high relative to zero, low relative to what's safe. So I would very much object. Be careful with the use of that term, because I don't think that's a fair use of the term.
I'd like to call, Senator Cruz, and then Gail Shibley. We want to hurry and get her testimony in. And I also want to read into the record before I forget, which I have done before, Ann Soto, who's professor and in the Department of Anatomy and Cell Biology at Tufts University School of Medicine. Her testimony, as well as Oregon Medical Association's testimony in favor of SB 945 and SJ8. Okay, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to take a slight issue with my dear friend when she opined that the industry is here for economic reasons, and I'm not disputing that, but I would suggest that everybody that's here is here for an economic reason. Advocacy groups, if they don't have issues, nobody's going to give them money to be an advocacy group. Academic studies are funded by somebody. So there is an economic interest vested, I think, in all sides of these issues. So I just wanted to put that on the record. That everybody has a stake, and ultimately it probably all does come down to dollars. So
even the legislature?
Well, we work for virtually free, but that's a whole other issue.
Madam Chair, if I could, in closing, I would just like to say that I think we all make economic decisions in our lives. we also try to be responsible. And if I thought for one moment that my client wasn't being responsible in this, I wouldn't be representing them, and I hope Senator Carter knows that about me. I feel strongly about that. Beyond that, I want to thank Senator Carter for her graciousness with my clients from out of state and the time that she's given us and the staff time that John has given us, and I appreciate it very much, Senator Carter.
Thank you. Madam Chair, mm-hmm. I just want to say I don't mean to cast any kind of aspersions on Ms. Lawrence or anybody else if I said that. And the only thing I'm saying is that any issues that we deal with in this country, the bottom line is economics for the American engine, because that's who we are as Americans. So I didn't mean to cast, Doctor, please forgive me, Ms. Lawrence, forgive me if you think I cast any kind of aspersion, because that is not my intent. My intent was to say that all of the things that we do in life, we concern ourselves more about the bottom line, whether no matter what industry it is. And then the state legislature has to deal with it when we see sick people. That's my concern. I have lots of passion, as you see, in my passion, I don't mean to offend anyone ever do I intend to do that. But I still hold on to my theory. And that is that many times decisions that we make in this world are based on economics, and I still hold true to that.
And if I may, I would like to respond to that, because also you asked about its effect on industry.
Right.
And I can speak for the Toy Industry Association in that it was mentioned previously in this hearing that toy manufacturers had moved away from the use of phthalates at the request of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. And that is true, but what's important to note about that conversation was that they were asked to voluntarily move away from the use of phthalates temporarily while the CPSC could conduct its risk assessment. So members of the toy industry agreed to pull products from shelves in that interim. But upon the CPSC's completion of their study, they were free to return the products to the shelves. And then on your comment regarding about that it all comes down to money,
mm-hmm.
I think that's very true. But I would not be here if it were just about money. These are the same products that I confidently give my own three children. And it's true that you could say that everything in business comes down to money. But if you look at the toy industry, it would be a very poor business model to market unsafe products. You could never succeed. So that is why safety has become our number one priority and has been for nearly seven decades. And that's why I'm here today.
Yeah, the only thing that I would say to that, if the states across the United States had really, really taken the science of tobacco, we would not have had the kind of epidemic in that we've had in this country in terms of not only cancer but other diseases associated with it. And so had it not been for the economics in the environment and all of the associated industries that we look at. So I'm not just trying to put down the toy industry at all, but I'm talking about bottom line economics, whether it's in this case or in other cases in this country. Period. I firmly believe that. And I'm going to hold on to my passion like you're going to hold on to yours.
Thank you, Senator Carter. Thank you, panel, very much. I do want the committee to know that I received some markups on the amendment to the joint memorial that the proponents and Mr. Marquis have accepted. You're not.
If I could, Madam Chair, I don't know that I've even seen the final version.
Okay.
John and I were kind of out here working on language, and I don't want to create a problem here, but I would like to have an opportunity to kind of look that over before we
fine
do something.
Gail Shibley, please come forward.
Yes, and we will.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Members of the committee, I'm Gail Shibley, administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health. I work for a non-for-profit public health division of DHS. don't think anyone can accuse us of that. Only jesting. Public health, of course, is all about prevention, and it's much cheaper, much more humane to change the environment around a population than it is to try to do individual interventions when the symptoms of disease and illness occur. Environmental public health, therefore, really leads that effort in along. To a large extent in changing the environment. In fact, to tremendous success over the centuries, 90%, it's reported, of increased human lifespan is not due to the wonderful technologies and life-saving interventions of triple bypass and open heart and all the terrifically heroic medical operations and so on that are available today, but rather to making sure our water is safe, making sure our food is safe, and otherwise making sure that we are not putting and keeping people in an environment in which it is difficult for them to be healthy. Now that is, when I say we've been tremendously successful in that way, historically that has been in terms of battling acute diseases. We no longer have epidemics of dysentery in this country. We no longer, those are, you know, very acute manifestations. I wish we could say, as in terms of public health, we've been as successful with chronic low-level exposures, but we have not. That's something that, as you can imagine, it is pretty difficult to identify over a span of decades in a very mobile society exactly because this resulted in that, years, decades later. It's just some of the challenge of doing that. As you've heard earlier today, this, in many ways, the issue that you're addressing is a federal, a federal issue. And yet, there are things that states can do, and I know, among other things, because my colleagues around the country, the state environmental health directors, that we get together via conference call every month, this issue is among the variety of issues that we discuss. I want to, on behalf of public health, thank and applaud the leadership of Senator Carter as well as Chair Monis Anderson and certainly Senator Gordley on the broader issue of environmental justice to make sure that our environment is safe. Specifically to phthalates, therefore, this discussion is extremely timely and quite important. While, as you have heard, and I'm not a scientist and I don't play one in the legislature, but we do know that there is growing recognition around the world and in scientific circles about the effects of phthalates on human health, on animals, and on the environment. The phthalate family of compounds is very large and diverse, as you've heard. Phthalates in general are common ingredients in all kinds of consumer products that we use every single day. I see the wonderful Nalgene bottle in front of me. Animal studies, has been noted, have linked, causally linked some phthalates with hormonal effects. Human studies to date, we have found from our limited literature search and examination, have found correlation between phthalates and adverse health effects. The phthalates-related causation of such effects remain both unknown and vigorously debated. In light of the regulatory bans elsewhere and growing consumer concern and discussion in this country, really attention in Oregon is very timely. While While my office in Oregon State Public Health, Environmental Public Health, does not have the infrastructure to research, regulate, or otherwise lead this effort and discussion, we wholeheartedly support the policy of the precautionary principle in this way, and the focus to engage the public, to inform, and to protect the public's health. Our mission really is to make sure that people have the choices and the conditions and the information they need to keep themselves and their families safe. I appreciate the opportunity to offer these few comments today.
Thank you, Ms. Shibley. Any comment?
Okay, yes, Senator Gordon.
I just thank Ms. Shibley for reinforcing that fundamental principle of public health, the precautionary principle, which is to do no harm. I appreciate you bringing that forward in your testimony. And then also looking at the joint memorial that Senator Carter has brought forward, it is interesting to me to note that there are other countries outside of Europe that have banned phthalates. Argentina, Fiji, Japan, Mexico. Again, just to put that information on record as well.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would...
We need to get to the floor. I'm sorry, Ms. Shipley.
Only ensure that as you craft whatever policy that you include understanding of enforcement and oversight to actually make it as meaningful as possible. I appreciate your attention. Thank you.
Thank you. And Senator Carter, you handed me some markups on the amendment.
Right.
So there will be changes to the amendment.
That's right.
And I would like to bring this back, work session April 30th. That's the last day that we can get it in unless the amendments come earlier.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I would like to move. So I will close the public hearing on SB 944 and SJM 8, and I would like to make sure that we move Senate Bill 153 to our next meeting, carry over to our next meeting. And any other things I need to do before I adjourn?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.